This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Hounded, the Iron Druid Chronicles by Kevin Hearn. Performed by Luke Daniels. Look, Mom, I made this. Can we put it on the fridge? Hounded, Chapter 1. There are many perks to living for 21 centuries, and foremost among them is bearing witness to the rare birth of genius. It invariably goes like this. Someone shrugs off the weight of his cultural traditions, ignores the baleful stares of authority, and does something his countrymen think to be completely batshit insane. Of those, Galileo was my personal favorite. Van Gogh comes in second, but he really was batshit insane. Thank the goddess I don't look like a guy who met Galileo, or who saw Shakespeare's plays when they first debuted, or rode with the hordes of Genghis Khan. When people ask how old I am, I just tell them 21, and if they assume I mean years instead of decades or centuries, then that can't be my fault, can it? I still get carded, in fact, which any senior citizen will tell you is immensely flattering. The young Irish lad facade does not stand me in good stead when I'm trying to appear scholarly at my place of business. I run an occult bookshop with an apothecary's counter squeezed in the corner. But it has one outstanding advantage. When I go to the grocery store, for example, and people see my curly red hair, fair skin, and long goatee, they suspect that I play soccer and drink lots of Guinness. If I'm going sleeveless and they see the tattoos all up and down my right arm, they assume I'm in a rock band and smoke lots of weed. It never enters their mind for a moment that I could be an ancient druid. And that's the main reason why I like this look. If I grew a white beard and got myself a pointy hat, oozed dignity and sagacity, and glowed with beatitude, people might start to get the wrong, or the right, idea. Sometimes I forget what I look like and I do something out of character, such as sing shepherd tunes in Aramaic while I'm waiting in line at Starbucks. But the nice bit about living in urban America is that people tend to either ignore eccentrics or move to the suburbs to escape them. That never would have happened in the old days. People who were different back then got burned at the stake or stoned to death. There is still a downside to being different today, of course, which is why I put so much effort into blending in. But the downside is usually just harassment and discrimination, and that is a vast improvement over dying for the common man's entertainment. Living in the modern world contains quite a few vast improvements like that. Most old souls I know think the attraction of modernity rests on clever ideas like indoor plumbing and sunglasses. But for me, the true attraction of America is that it's practically godless. When I was younger and dodging the Romans, I could hardly walk a mile in Europe without stepping on a stone sacred to some god or other. But out here in Arizona, all I have to worry about is the occasional encounter with Coyote, and I actually rather like him. He's nothing like Thor, for one thing, and that right there means we're going to get along fine. The local college kids would describe Thor as a major asshat, if they ever had the misfortune to meet him. Even better than the low god density in Arizona is the near total absence of fairies. I don't mean those cute winged creatures that Disney calls fairies. I mean the Fae, the She, the actual descendants of the Tuatha De Danann, born in Tir na n'Og, the land of eternal youth, each one of them as likely to gut you as hug you. They don't dig me all that much, so I try to settle in places they can't reach very easily. They have all sorts of gateways to Earth in the old world, but in the new world, they need oak, ash, and thorn to make the journey, and those trees don't grow together too often in Arizona. I have found a couple of likely places, like the White Mountains near the border with New Mexico, and a riparian area near Tucson. But those are both over 100 miles away from my well-paved neighborhood near the university in Tempe. I figured the chances of the Fae entering the world there and then crossing a treeless desert to look for a rogue druid were extremely small. So when I found this place in the late 90s, I decided to stay until the locals grew suspicious. It was a great decision for more than a decade. I set up a new identity, leased some shop space, hung out a sign that said Third Eye Books and Herbs, an allusion to Vedic and Buddhist beliefs because I thought a Celtic name would bring up a red flag to those searching for me, and bought a small house within easy biking distance. I sold crystals and tarot cards to college kids who wanted to shock their Protestant parents, scores of ridiculous tomes with spells in them for lovey-dovey Wiccans, and some herbal remedies for people looking to make an end run around the doctor's office. I even stocked extensive works on Druid magic, all of them based on Victorian revivals, all of them utter rubbish, and all vastly entertaining to me whenever I sold any of them. Maybe once a month I had a serious magical customer looking for a genuine grimoire, stuff you don't mess with or even know about until you're fairly accomplished. I did much more of my rare book business via the internet, another vast improvement of modern times. But when I set up my identity and my place of business, I did not realize how easy it would be for someone else to find me by doing a public records search on the internet. The idea that any of the old ones would even try it never occurred to me. I thought they'd try to scry me or use other methods of divination, but never the internet. So I was not as careful in choosing my name as I should have been. I should have called myself John Smith or something utterly sad and plain like that, but my pride would not let me wear a Christian name. So I used O'Sullivan, the anglicized version of my real surname, and for everyday usage I employed the decidedly Greek name of Atticus. A supposedly 21-year-old O'Sullivan, who owned an occult bookstore and sold extremely rare books he had no business knowing about, was enough information for the Fae to find me, though. On a Friday, 3 weeks before Soin, they jumped me in front of my shop when I walked outside to take a lunch break. A sword swished below my knees without so much as a have at thee, and the arm swinging it pulled its owner off balance when I jumped over it. I crunched a quick left elbow into his face as he tried to recover, and that was one fairy down, four to go. Thank the gods below for paranoia. I classified it as a survival skill rather than a neurotic condition. It was a keen knife's edge, sharpened for centuries against the grindstone of people who want to kill me. It was what made me wear an amulet of cold iron around my neck, and cloak my shop not only with iron bars, but also with magical wards designed to keep out the Fae and other undesirables. It was what made me train in unarmed combat and test my speed against vampires, and what had saved me countless times from thugs like these. Perhaps thug is too heavy a word for them. It connotes an abundance of muscle tissue and a profound want of intellect. These lads didn't look as if they had ever hit the gym or heard of anabolic steroids. They were lean, ropey types who had chosen to disguise themselves as cross-country runners, bare-chested and wearing nothing but maroon shorts and expensive running shoes. To any passerby, it would look as if they were trying to beat me up with brooms, but that was just a glamour they had cast on their weapons. The pointy parts were in the twigs, so if I was unable to see through their illusions, I would have been fatally surprised when the nice broom stabbed my vitals. Since I could see through fairy glamours, I noticed that two of my remaining four assailants carried spears, and one of them was circling around to my right. Underneath their human guises, they looked like the typical fairy. That is, no wings, scantily clad, and kind of man-pretty, like Orlando Bloom's Legolas, the sort of people you see in salon product advertisements. The ones with spears stabbed at me simultaneously from the sides, but I slapped the tips away with either wrist so that they thrust past me to the front and back. Then I lunged inside the guard of the one to the right and clotheslined him with a forearm to his throat. Tough to breathe through a crushed windpipe. Two down now, but they were quick and deft, and their dark eyes held no gleam of mercy. I had left my back open to attack by lunging to the right, so I spun and raised my left forearm high to block the blow I knew was coming. Sure enough, there was a sword about to arc down into my skull, and I caught it on my arm at the top of the swing. It bit down to the bone, and that hurt a lot, but not nearly as much as it would have if I had let it fall. I grimaced at the pain and stepped forward to deliver a punishing, open-hand blow to the fairy's solar plexus, and he flew back into the wall of my shop, the wall ribbed with bars of iron. Three down, and I smiled at the remaining two, who were not so zealous as before to take a shot at me. Three of their buddies had not only been physically beaten, but also magically poisoned by physical contact with me. My cold iron amulet was bound to my aura, and by now they could no doubt see it. I was some sort of iron druid, their worst nightmare made flesh. My first victim was already disintegrating into ash, and the other two were close to realizing that all we are is dust in the wind. I was wearing sandals, and I kicked them off and stepped back a bit toward the street, so that the fairies had a wall full of iron at their backs. Besides being a good idea strategically, it put me closer to a thin strip of landscaping between the street and the sidewalk, where I could draw power from the earth to close up my wound and kill the pain. Knitting the muscle tissue I could worry about later. My immediate concern was stopping the bleeding, because there were too many scary things an unfriendly magician could do with my blood. As I sank my feet into the grass and drew power from it for healing, I also sent out a call, sort of an instant message through the earth, to an iron elemental I knew, informing him that I had two fairies standing in front of me if he wanted a snack. He would answer quickly because the earth is bound to me as I am bound to it, but it might take him a few moments. To give him time, I asked my assailants a question. Out of curiosity, were you guys trying to capture me or kill me? The one to my left, hefting a short sword in his right hand, decided to snarl at me rather than answer.
Tell us where the sword is.
Which sword? The one in your hand? It's still in your hand, big guy.
You know which sword. Fragara, the Answerer.
Don't know what you're talking about. I shook my head. Who sent you guys? Are you sure you have the right fella?
We're sure.
Spear guy sneered.
You have druidic tattoos and you can see through our glamour.
But lots of magical folk can do that. And you don't have to be a druid to appreciate Celtic knotwork.
Think about it, fellas.
You've come to ask me about some sword, but clearly I don't have one or I would have whipped it out by now. All I'm asking you to consider is that maybe you've been sent here to get killed. Are you sure the motives of the person who sent you are entirely pure?
Us? Get killed?
Sword guy spluttered at me for being so ridiculous.
When it's 5 against 1?
It's 2 against 1 now, just in case you missed the part where I killed 3 of you. Maybe the person who sent you knew it would happen like that.
Angus O would never do that to us!
Spear guy exclaimed, and my suspicions were confirmed. I had a name now, and that name had been chasing me for 2 millennia.
We're his own blood!
Angus Og tricked his own father out of his home. What does your kinship matter to the likes of him? Look, I've been here before, guys, and you haven't. The Celtic god of love loves nothing so much as himself. He'd never waste his time or risk his magnificent person on a scouting trip, so he sends a tiny little band of disposable offspring every time he thinks he's found me. If they ever come back, he knows it wasn't really me. See? Understanding began to dawn on their faces, and they crouched into defensive stances. But it was much too late for them, and they weren't looking in the right direction. The bars along the wall of my shop had melted silently apart behind them and morphed into jaws of sharp iron teeth. The giant black maw reached out for them and snapped closed, scissoring through the fairy's flesh as if it were cottage cheese, and then they were inhaled like jello, with time only for a startled, aborted scream. Their weapons clattered to the ground, all glamour gone, and then the iron mouth melted back into its wonted shape as a series of bars, after gracing me with a brief, satisfied grin. I got a message from the iron elemental before it faded away, in the short bursts of emotions and imagery that they use for language. Druid calls. Fairies await. Delicious. Gratitude. Chapter 2. I looked around to see who might have witnessed the fight, but there wasn't anyone close by. It was lunchtime. My shop is just south of University on Ash Avenue, and all the food places are north of University, up and down both Ash and Mill Avenues. I collected the weapons off the sidewalk and opened up the shop door, grinning to myself at the out-to-lunch sign. I flipped it around to say open. Might as well do some business, since cleaning up would keep me tied down to the shop. Heading over to my tea station, I filled a pitcher with water and checked my arm. It was still red and puffy from the cut, but doing well, and I had the pain firmly shut down. Still, I didn't think I should risk tearing the muscles further by asking them to carry water for me. I'd have to make 2 trips. I grabbed a jug of bleach from under the sink and went outside with it, leaving the pitcher on the counter. I poured bleach on every blood stain and then returned for the pitcher to wash it all away. After I'd satisfactorily washed away the blood, a giant crow flew into the shop behind me as I opened the door to return the pitcher. It perched itself on a bust of Ganesha, spreading its wings and ruffling its feathers in an aggressive display. It was the Morrigan, Celtic chooser of the slain and goddess of war, and she called me by my Irish name.
Sheehan O'Sullivan, she croaked dramatically. We must talk.
Can't you take the form of a human? I said, placing the pitcher on a rack to dry. The motion caused me to notice a spot of blood on my amulet, and I removed it from my neck to wash it off. It's creepy when you talk to me like that. Birdbeaks are incapable of forming fricatives, you know.
I did not journey here for a linguistics lesson, the Morrigan said. I have come with ill tidings. Angus Og knows you are here.
Well, yes, I already knew that. Didn't you just take care of 5 dead fairies? I laid my necklace on the counter and reached for a towel to pat it dry.
I sent them on to Menannon MacLear, she said, referring to the Celtic god who escorted the living to the land of the dead. But there is more. Angus Og is coming here himself and may even now be on his way.
I went still. Are you quite certain? I asked. This is based on solid evidence? The crow flapped its wings in irritation and cawed.
If you wait for evidence, it will be too late, she said.
Relief washed through me, and the tension melted from between my shoulder blades. Ah, so this is just some vague augury, I said.
No, the augury was quite specific, the Morrigan replied. A mortal doom gathers about you here, and you must fly if you wish to avoid it.
See, there you go again. You get this way every year around Samhain, I said. If it isn't Thor coming to get me, it's one of the Olympians. Remember that story last year? Apollo was offended by my association with the Arizona State Sun Devils.
This is different.
Never mind that I do not even attend the university, I just work nearby. So he was coming in his golden chariot to shoot me full of arrows. The crow shuffled on the bust and looked uncomfortable.
It seemed a plausible interpretation at the time.
The Greek deity of the sun, being offended by an old druid's tenuous relationship with a college mascot on the other side of the globe, seemed plausible?
The basics were accurate, Sheehan. Missiles were fired at you.
Some kids punctured my bike tires with darts, Morrigan. I think you may have exaggerated the threat somewhat.
Nevertheless, you cannot stay here any longer. The omens are dire.
Very well, I sighed in resignation. Tell me what you saw.
I was speaking with Angus recently.
You spoke to him? If I'd been eating anything, I would have choked. I thought you hated each other.
We do. That does not mean we are incapable of conversing together. I was relaxing in Tir na n'Og, thoroughly sated after a trip to Mesopotamia. Have you been there recently? It is magnificent sport.
Begging your pardon, but the mortals call it Iraq now, and no, I haven't been there in centuries. The Morrigan's ideas of sport and mine varied widely. As a chooser of the slain, she tends to enjoy nothing so much as a protracted war. She hangs out with Kali and the Valkyries, and they have a death goddess's night out on the battlefield. I, on the other hand, stopped thinking war was glorious after the Crusades. Baseball is more my kind of thing these days. What did Angus say to you? I prompted.
He just smiled at me and told me to look to my friends.
My eyebrows shot up. You have friends?
Of course not.
The crow ruffled its feathers and managed to look aggrieved at the mere suggestion.
Well, Hecate is kind of funny, and we have been spending a lot of time together lately. But I think he meant you.
The Morrigan and I have a certain understanding, though it's too uncertain for my taste. She will not come for me as long as my existence continues to drive Angus Og into twitching spasms of fury. It's not exactly a friendship. She's not the sort of creature that allows it. But we've known each other a long time, and she drops by every so often to keep me out of trouble.
It would be embarrassing for me,
she explained once as she was ushering me out of the Battle of Gora.
If you got yourself decapitated and yet you didn't die, I would have some explaining to do. Dereliction of duty is difficult to justify. So from now on, do not put me in a position where I must take your life to save face.
The bloodlust was still on me at the time, and and I could feel the power coursing through my tattoos. I was part of the Fianna during that episode, and there was nothing I wanted more than to have a go at that pompous snot King Carbra. But the Morrigan had chosen sides, and when a goddess of death says to leave the battle, you leave the battle. Ever since I earned Angus Ogg's enmity, all those centuries ago, she has tried to warn me of mortal dangers coming my way, and while she occasionally exaggerates the danger, I suppose I should be grateful she never underestimates it, or neglects to warn me at all. He could have been playing with your mind, Morrigan, I said. Angus is like that.
I am well aware. That is why I consulted the flight of crows and found them ominous regarding your position here.
I made a face and the Morrigan continued before I could say anything.
I knew that such augury would not be sufficient for you, so, seeking more specifics, I cast the wands.
Oh, I said. She had actually gone to some trouble. There are all sorts of ways to cast lots or runes or otherwise practice divination by interpreting the random as the pattern of the future. I prefer them all to watching the flight of birds or watching clouds, because my involvement in the casting centers the randomness on me. Birds fly because they want to eat or mate or grab something for their nest, and applying that to my future or anyone else's seems a ludicrous stretch to me. Logically, throwing some sticks on the ground and making predictions is little better, except that I know that my agency and will in the ritual provide enough focus for fortune to stop and say, "Here's what's coming soon to a theater near you." There used to be a class of druids that practiced animal sacrifice and read the future from entrails, which I kind of thought was messy and a waste of a good chicken or bull or whatever. People today look at those practices and say, "That's so cruel! Why couldn't they simply be vegan like me?" But the druidic faith allows for a pretty happy afterlife and maybe even a return trip or 10 to Earth. Since the soul never dies, taking a knife to some flesh here and there is never a big deal. Still, I never got into the whole sacrificing thing. There are far cleaner and more reliable ways to peek under fortune's skirts. Druids like me use 20 wands in a bag, each marked with Ogham script representing the 20 trees native to Ireland, and each carrying with it a wealth of prophetic meaning. Much like tarot, these wands are interpreted differently depending on which direction they fall in relation to the diviner. There is a positive set of meanings if they fall upright, a negative set if they fall downward. Without looking, the caster draws 5 wands from the bag and tosses them on the ground in front of him, then tries to interpret the message represented by their arrangement. "And how did they fall?" I asked the Morrigan.
4 of them were fell, she said, and waited for that to sink in. It wasn't going to be a happy time.
"I see. And which of the trees spoke to you?" The Morrigan regarded me as if her next words would cause me to swoon like a corseted Jane Austen character.
"Fern, Chinne, Nietel, Ura, Io."
Alder, holly, reed, heather, and yew. The first represented a warrior and was simultaneously the most clearly interpreted and the most vague. The others all suggested that some pretty dire shit was going to befall said warrior, whoever he was. Holly signaled challenges and ordeals, reed screamed of fear, heather warned of surprises, and yew prophesied death. "Ah," I said, as nonchalantly as I could. "And how precisely did the alder and the yew fall in relationship to each other?"
"The yew crossed the alder."
Well, that was fairly clear. The warrior was going to die. He'd be surprised by its arrival, scared witless, and he'd fight maniacally against it, but his death was inevitable. The Morrigan noted my acceptance of the casting and said,
"So where will you go?"
"I have not decided yet."
"There are even more isolated places in the Mojave Desert,"
she suggested, with a slight emphasis on the name. I think she was trying to impress me with her knowledge of American geography, since she had bungled the Iraq thing. I wondered if she knew about the dissolution of Yugoslavia, or if she even knew that Transylvania was now part of Romania. Immortals don't always pay much attention to current events. "I mean, Morrigan, I have not decided to go yet." The crow on the bust of Ganesha said nothing, but the eyes flashed red for a brief second, and that, I admit, made me a bit uncomfortable. She really wasn't my friend. One day, and it could be today, she would decide I'd lived far too long and grown far too cavalier, and that would be it for me. "Just give me a few minutes to think about the casting," I said, and realized immediately afterward that I should have chosen my words more carefully. The red eyes came back, and the crow's voice was pitched lower than before, with minor harmonics in it that raised the hairs on the back of my neck.
"You would pit your divination skills against mine?"
"No, no," I hastened to reassure her. "I'm trying to catch up with you, that's all. Now, I'm just thinking aloud here, okay? That alder wand, the warrior, that does not necessarily have to mean me, does it?" The red eyes faded back to a more natural black, and the Morrigan shifted her weight impatiently on the bust.
"Of course not," she said in her normal tone. The minor harmonics were gone. "It could technically be anyone who fights you, should you prevail. But my focus was on you when I made the casting, and so you are most likely to be the warrior the Alder Wand represents. This fight is coming, whether you will or no."
"But here's my question. You've let me live for centuries because it vexes Angus Og. Angus and I are probably linked somewhat in your mind. So when you did the casting, is it not possible that Angus Og was also in your thoughts?" The Morrigan cawed and hopped onto Ganesha's trunk, then hopped back up to the top of the head, twitching her wings a bit. She knew the answer, but she didn't like it because she knew where I was going with this.
"Possible, yes," she hissed. "But it is unlikely."
"But you must admit, Morrigan, that it is also unlikely Angus Og would leave Tir na n'og to hunt me down himself. He's far more likely to employ surrogates, as he has done for centuries now." Angus's strengths ran to charm and networking, making people love him, in other words, so that they'd offer to do him any little favor, like killing wayward druids. He'd sent practically every sort of thug and assassin imaginable against me over the years. My favorites were the camel-mounted Egyptian Mamelukes. But he seemed to realize that taking up the chase personally would diminish him, especially since I kept living to escape another day. A hint of smugness might have crept into my tone as I continued. "And I can handle any of the lesser fae he should choose to send after me, as I proved just moments ago." The crow leapt off the bust of Ganesha and flew straight at my face, but before I could get worried about a beak in the eye, the bird sort of melted in midair, reforming into a naked, statuesque woman with milk-white skin and raven hair. It was the Morrigan as seductress, and she caught me rather unprepared. Her scent had me responding before she ever touched me, and by the time she closed the remaining distance between us, I was ready to invite her back to my place. Or here would be fine. Right here, right now, by the tea station. She draped an arm around my shoulder and trailed her nails down the back of my neck, causing me to shudder involuntarily. A smile tugged at the corners of her mouth at that, and she pressed her body against mine and leaned forward to whisper in my ear.
"And what if he sends a succubus to slay you, most wise and ancient druid? You'd be dead inside a minute if he knew this weakness of yours."
I heard what she said, and a small corner of my mind realized that it could be of some importance. But the largest part of me could think of nothing except the way she was making me feel. The Morrigan stepped back abruptly, and I tried to clutch at her, but she slapped me viciously across the face and told me to snap out of it as I crumpled to the floor. I snapped out of it. The scent that had so intoxicated me was gone, and the pain spreading across my cheek banished the physical need I had felt. "Ow," I said. "Thanks for that. I was about to go into full-on leg-humping mode."
"This is a serious vulnerability you have, Sheehan. Angus could simply pay a mortal woman to do his work for him."
"He tried that when I was last in Italy," I said, as I grabbed the edge of the sink to help myself up. The Morrigan is not the sort to give a man a hand. "And I've faced succubi as well. I have an amulet to protect me against such things."
"Then why aren't you wearing it?"
"I took it off just a moment ago to wash it. Besides, I'm safe inside my store and my home from the Fae."
"Clearly not, Druid, because here I stand."
Yes, there she stood, naked. That could prove awkward if anyone walked through the door. "Your pardon, Morrigan,"
I am safe from all save the Tuatha De Danann. If you look carefully, you will notice the bindings I have set about the place. They should hold against the lesser Fae and most anything he could send from hell." The Morrigan tilted her head upward and her eyes lost focus for a moment, and it was then that a pair of unfortunate college lads wandered into my shop. I could tell that they were drunk, even though it was only mid-afternoon. Their hair was greasy, and they wore concert t-shirts and jeans, and they had not shaved for several days. I knew the type. They were stoners who were wondering if I had anything smokable behind my apothecary counter. Conversations with them usually began with them asking if my herbs had medicinal benefits. After my affirmative response, they would ask me if I had anything with hallucinogenic properties. I usually sold these types a bag of sage and thyme under an exotic name and sent them on their merry way, because I have no scruples about separating idiots from their money. They'd get headaches from the experience and never return. What I feared was that these particular lads would see the Morrigan and never leave alive. Sure enough, one of them, wearing a meatloaf shirt, saw the Morrigan standing bare-assed in the middle of my shop, hands on hips, looking like a goddess, and he pointed her out to his friend in the Iron Maiden shirt.
"Dude, that chick is naked?"
Meatloaf exclaimed.
"Whoa,"
said Iron Maiden, who pushed his sunglasses down his nose to get a better look.
"And she's hot, too."
"Hey, baby," Meatloaf said, taking a couple of steps toward her. "If you need some clothes, I'll be glad to take off my pants for you."
He and his friend began to laugh as if this was incredibly funny, spitting out like automatic weapons fire. They sounded like goats, only less intelligent. The Morrigan's eyes flashed red and I held up my hands.
"Morrigan, no, please, not in my shop. Cleaning up afterward would cause me tremendous hardship."
"They must die for their impertinence,"
she said, and those hair-raising minor harmonics were back in her voice. Anyone with a cursory knowledge of mythology knows that it is suicidal to sexually harass a goddess. Look what Artemis did to that guy who stumbled across her bathing.
"I understand that this insult must be redressed," I said, "but if you could do it elsewhere so that my life is not further complicated, I would appreciate the courtesy very much."
"Very well,"
she muttered to me.
"I just ate in any case."
And then she turned to the stoners and gave them the full frontal view. They were overjoyed at first. They were looking down and so did not see that her eyes were glowing red. But when she spoke, her unearthly voice rattled the windows and their eyes snapped up to her face and they realized they were not dealing with the average girl gone wild.
"Put your affairs in order, mortals,"
she boomed as a gust of wind, yes, wind inside my shop, blew their hair back.
"I will feast on your hearts tonight for the offense you gave me. So swears the Morrigan."
I thought it was a bit melodramatic, but one does not criticize a death goddess on her oratory delivery.
"Dude, what the hell?"
Iron Maiden squealed in a voice a couple of octaves above his prior register.
"I don't know, man,"
Meatloaf said,
"but my chubby is gone. I'm bailing."
They tripped over each other in their haste to get out. The Morrigan watched them go with predatory interest, and I kept silent as her head tracked their flight even through the walls. Finally, she turned to me and said,
"They are polluted creatures. They have defiled themselves."
I nodded. "Aye, but they are unlikely to provide you much sport." I was not about to defend them or beg for a stay of execution. The best I could do was imply that they were not worth the trouble.
"That is true," she said. "They are pathetic shadows of true men, but they will die tonight nevertheless. I have sworn it."
"Oh well," I sighed inwardly. I had tried. The Morrigan calmed herself and returned her attention to me.
"The defenses you have here are surprisingly subtle and unusually strong,"
she said, and I nodded my thanks.
"But they will not serve you well against the Tuatha De Danann. I counsel you to leave immediately."
I pressed my lips together and took a moment to choose my words carefully. "I appreciate your counsel and I am eternally grateful for your interest in my survival," I replied. "But I cannot think of a better place to defend myself. I've been running for 2 millennia, Morrigan, and I am tired. If Angus truly means to come for me, then let him come. He'll be as weak here as anywhere on Earth. It is time we settled this.
The Morrigan tilted her head at me.
You would truly offer arms against him on this plane?
I am resolved. I wasn't, but the Morrigan is not renowned for her bullshit detection. She's more renowned for whimsical slaughter and recreational torture. The Morrigan sighed.
I think it smacks of foolishness more than courage, but so be it. Let me see this amulet, then, your so-called defense.
Gladly. Would you mind clothing yourself, however, so that we may avoid any further shocks to mortal eyes? The Morrigan smirked. She was not only built like a Victoria's Secret model, but the sun streaming through the windows lit up her smooth, flawless skin, which was white as confectioner's sugar.
It is only this prudish age that makes a vice of nudity, but perhaps it is wiser to bow to local custom for now.
She made a gesture, and a black robe materialized to cloak her form. I smiled my gratitude and picked up my amulet from the counter. It would perhaps be more accurate to describe it as a charm necklace. Not charms like you'll find on a Tiffany bracelet, but charms that will quickly execute spells for me that otherwise would take a long time to cast. It took me 750 years to complete the necklace, because it was built around a cold iron amulet in the center designed to protect me against the Fae and other magic users. Angus Ogg's constant attempts to kill me had made it necessary. I had bound the amulet to my aura, an excruciating process of my own devising, but worth every second in the end. To any of the lesser Fae, it made me an invincible badass, because as beings of pure magic, they cannot abide iron in any form. Iron is the antithesis of magic, which is why magic largely died on this world with the advent of the Iron Age. It had taken me 300 years to bind the amulet to my aura, providing me with tremendous protection and a literal fist of death whenever I touched one of the Fae. The remaining 450 were spent constructing the charms and finding a way to make my magic work in such close proximity to the iron, and my newly tainted aura. The problem with the Tuatha De Danann was that they were not beings of pure magic like their descendants born in the land of Faerie. They were beings of this world who merely used magic better than anyone else, and the Irish had long ago elevated them to gods. So the iron bars around my shop would not bother the Morrigan or any of her kin, and neither would my aura do them any damage. All the iron did was even the odds a bit so that their magic would not overwhelm me. They had to stoop to physical attack if they wished to do me any harm. That, more than anything else, was the reason I was still breathing. The Morrigan aside, the Tuatha De Danann were loath to subject themselves to physical combat, because they were as vulnerable as I to a well-timed sword thrust. Through magic they had prolonged their lives for millennia, just as I had staved off the ravages of aging. But violence could bring an end to them, as it had to Lu and Nua and others of their kind. It made them prone to use assassins and poisons and other forms of cowardly attack when their magic would not suffice, and Angus Og had tried most of them already on me.
Remarkable,
the Morrigan said, fingering the amulet and shaking her head. It's not a universal defense, I pointed out, but it's pretty good if I do say so myself. She looked up at me.
How did you do it?
I shrugged. Mostly patience. Iron can be bent to your will if your will is stronger than the iron, but it is a slow, laborious process of centuries, and you need the help of an elemental.
What happens to it when you change your shape?
It shrinks or grows to an appropriate size. It was the first thing I learned how to do with it.
I have never seen its like.
The Morrigan frowned.
Who taught you this magic?
No one. It is my own original craft.
Then you will teach me this craft, Druid.
It was not a request. I did not respond right away, but rather looked down at the necklace and grasped a single one of the charms. It was a silver square stamped in bas-relief with the likeness of a sea otter, and I held it up for the Morrigan's inspection. This charm, when activated, allows me to breathe underwater and swim like I was native unto the element. It works in conjunction with the iron amulet here in the center, which protects me from the wiles of selkies, sirens, and the like. It makes me second only to Manannan MacLear in the sea, and it took me more than 200 years to perfect it. And that is just one of the many valuable charms on this necklace. What do you offer me in exchange for this knowledge?
your continued existence,
the Morrigan spat. I thought she would say something like that. The Morrigan has never been noted for her diplomacy. That is a good beginning for negotiations, I replied. Shall we formalize it? I will teach you this new druidry, painstakingly formulated over centuries of trial and error, in exchange for your eternal ignorance of my mortality. In other words, you will not take me. Ever.
You are asking for true immortality.
And for this you receive magic that will make you supreme amongst the Tuatha De Danann.
I am already supreme, druid,
she growled. Some of your cousins may beg to differ, I replied, thinking of the goddess Briet, who currently ruled in Tir na n'Og as first among the Fae. In any case, regardless of your decision, you have my word, freely given, that I will not teach this magic to any of them under any inducement.
Fairly spoken, she said after a pause, and I began breathing again. Very well. You will teach me how each charm on this necklace was achieved under the terms you described, and how you bound the iron to your aura, and I will let you live forever.
Smiling, I told her to find a lump of cold iron to use as her amulet, and then we could begin.
You should still fly from here now,
she told me when we had sealed the bargain.
Just because I will never take you does not mean you are safe from other gods of death. If Angus defeats you, one of them will come eventually.
Let me worry about Angus, I said. Worrying about him was my specialty. If love and hate were two sides of the same coin, Angus spent an awful lot of time on the hate side for a god of love, especially where I was concerned. I also had to worry about the effects of aging, and if I lost a limb, it wasn't going to grow back. Being immortal did not make me invincible. Look at what the Bacchants did to that poor Orpheus fella.
Done, the Morrigan replied. But beware the agency of humans first. Working at the behest of Angus, one of them has found you on some sort of new device called the Internet. Do you know of it?
I use it every day, I said, nodding. If it was less than a century old, then it qualified as new to the Morrigan.
Based on the word of this human, Angus Og is sending some firbolgs here to confirm that Atticus O'Sullivan is the ancient druid Sheahan O'Sullivan. You should have used a different name.
I'm a stupid git, and no doubt about it, I said, shaking my head, piecing together how they must have found me. The Morrigan's expression softened, and she grasped my chin in her fingers, pulling my mouth to hers. Her black robe melted away into nothingness. She stood before me like a Nagel poster come to life, and the heady scent of everything desirable to a man again filled my nostrils, though the effect was muted since I was now wearing my amulet. She kissed me deeply and then pulled away with that same maddening smirk on her face, knowing the effect she had on me, magically assisted or not.
Wear your amulet at all times from now on, she said, and call on me, druid, when you have need. I have some humans to hunt now.
And with that she turned back into the battle crow and flew out the door of my shop, which opened of its own accord to grant her passage. Chapter 3 I've been around long enough to discount most superstitions for what they are. I was around when many of them began to take root, after all. But one superstition to which I happen to subscribe is that bad juju comes in threes. The saying in my time was, storm clouds are thrice cursed. But I can't talk like that and expect people to believe I'm a 21-year-old American. I have to say things like, shit happens, man. The Morrigan's exit did not put me at ease, therefore, because I fully expected the day to get worse from there. I closed up my shop a couple of hours early and headed home on my mountain bike with my necklace tucked inside my shirt, worrying a bit about what might be waiting for me there. I headed west on University from my shop and took a left on Roosevelt, heading south into the Mitchell Park neighborhood. Before the dams got put up on the Salt River, the area was floodplain land with very fertile soil. It was farmland originally, and the lots were gradually subdivided and built up from the 1930s through the 60s, complete with front porches and irrigated lawns. Usually I took my time and enjoyed the ride.
I would say hello to the dogs who barked a greeting at me, or stop to chat with the Widow McDonough, who liked to sit on her front porch, sipping sweaty glasses of Tullamore Dew as the sun set. She spoke the Irish with me and told me I was a nice young lad with an old soul, and I enjoyed the conversation and the irony of being the young one. I usually did her yard work for her once a week, and she liked to watch me do it, declaring loudly each time that,
"If I were 50 years younger, laddie, I'd jump your wee bones and tell no one but the Lord, ye can be sure."
But today I hurried, tossing a quick wave at the widow's porch and churning my legs as fast as they would go. I took a right onto 11th Street and slowed, stretching out my senses in search of trouble. When I pulled up to my house, I did not go in right away. Rather, I squatted near the street and sank the fingers of my tattooed right hand into the grass of my lawn to check on my defenses. My house was built in the 50s, a north-facing cottage with a white-posted raised porch and a flower bed in front of it. The lawn in front is dominated by a single towering mesquite tree planted to the right of center, while a driveway on the right leads into a garage. A flagstone path goes from the driveway to my porch and the front door. My front window told me nothing, being cast completely in late afternoon shadow. But by examining my wards through the grass, yes, someone was there. And since no mortal or lesser fae could ever break through the wards on my house, that meant I had two choices. Get the hell out now, or go find out which member of the Tuatha De Danann had untied my knots and was waiting for me inside. It could be Angus Og, and the thought chilled me even though it was nearly 100 degrees outside. Arizona does not cool down to sensible temperatures until the second half of October, and we were still a week or so away from that. But I could not imagine him leaving Tierna Nog, despite the Morrigan's insistence that he was on his way. So I checked in with my pet. Well, I should say in all honesty my friend, Oberon, with whom I was specially bound. "How goes it, my friend?"
"Atticus, someone is here,"
Oberon answered from the backyard. I did not pick up any tension in his thoughts. I rather got the impression that his tail was wagging. The fact that he had not been barking on my arrival was another clue that he thought everything was fine. "I know. Who is it?"
"I do not know. I like her, though. She said perhaps we would go hunting later."
"She spoke to you? In your mind, like me?" It took some effort to make an animal understand human language. It was not a simple binding, and not all of the Tuatha De Danann would bother. Most often they confine themselves to communicating emotions and images, as one does when speaking to an elemental.
"Aye, she did. She told me I remind her of my sires of old."
High praise. Oberon was indeed a magnificent specimen of Irish wolfhound, with a rich dark gray coat and sturdy constitution. His sires of old were called warhounds, not wolfhounds, and they accompanied the Irish into battle, unhorsing cavalry and attacking chariots. The warhounds of my youth were rather less friendly creatures, not like the gentle wolfhounds of today. Indeed, most modern wolfhounds are so mild, bred for gentle dispositions for centuries, that they can scarcely conceive of attacking anything beyond a bowl of dry kibble. But Oberon personified a fine blend of characteristics, able to turn the savagery of his heritage on and off as occasion demanded. I found him online at a rescue ranch in Massachusetts after becoming frustrated with breeders in Arizona. Everything they had was too tame. Oberon, once I flew out to visit, was practically wild by modern standards. But of course all you needed to do was talk to him. He simply wanted to hunt once in a while. Allow him that, and he was a perfect gentleman. "No wonder you like her. Did she ask you any questions?"
"She only wondered when to expect you."
That was encouraging. She obviously wasn't looking for any of my treasures, and that meant she might not be in the employ of Angus Og. "I see. How long has she been here?"
"She arrived here recently."
Dogs are not all that great with time. They understand day and night, but beyond that they are nearly indifferent to its passage. So recently could mean anything from a minute ago to hours. "Have you taken a nap?" I asked, "since she got here?"
"No. We just finished speaking before you arrived."
"Thank you, Oberon."
"Will we go hunting soon?"
"That depends entirely on the visitor. Whoever she is, she was not invited."
"Oh."
A hint of uncertainty crept into Oberon's thoughts.
"Have I failed to protect you?"
Do not worry, Oberon, I said. I'm not displeased with you, but I am going to come back and get you, and we will enter the house together. I want you to guard me in case she proves not to be as friendly as you thought.
What if she attacks?
Kill her. One does not give the Tuatha De Danann second chances.
I thought you said never to attack humans.
She hasn't been human for a very long time.
All right. I do not think she will attack, though. She is a nice inhuman.
You mean non-human. Inhuman is an adjective, I said. As I rose from the lawn and padded softly around the left side of the house to the backyard.
Hey, I'm not a native speaker. Give me a break.
I left my bicycle resting in the street, hoping that it would not be stolen in a few minutes of neglect. Oberon was waiting for me as I opened the gate, his tongue lolling out and his tail wagging. I scratched him briefly behind the ears, and we walked together to my back door. The patio furniture seemed undisturbed. My herb garden, planted in rows of boxes along the back fence and in much of the area normally reserved for a lawn, grew unmolested. I found the visitor in my kitchen, trying to make a strawberry fruit smoothie.
Manon and MacLear take this cursed thing to the Land of Shades,
she shouted as she smashed her fist onto the buttons of my blender.
The mortals always push these buttons and the bloody things work. Why won't yours work?
She demanded, flipping an irritated glance my way. You have to plug it in, I explained.
What is this plug?
Insert the two-prong device at the end of that cord into the slots on the wall there. That will give the blender its, animating force. I thought I could explain electricity later if necessary. There was no use burdening her with new vocabulary.
Ah. Well met, then, Druid.
Well met, Flittish, goddess of the hunt.
Told you she was nice,
Oberon said. I had to admit that of all the Tuatha De Danann it could have been, Flittish was one of the most agreeable to find in my kitchen. But you know that old saying about storm clouds being thrice cursed? Flittish brought the second one rolling behind her, and I never saw it coming. Chapter 4
You know you cannot get one of these drinks in Tir na n'Og?
Flittish said above the whine of my blender. I thought as much, I replied. Blenders tend to be in short supply there. So how did you hear of them?
Only recently, as it turns out,
Flittish said, puffing an errant wisp of curling red hair away from her eyes as she watched the strawberries puree. It was a somewhat wind-blown mane she had, a bit frizzy and so natural that I thought I spied a twig or two reclining lazily in her locks.
I was guesting in the forest of Hearn the Hunter, and I caught a poacher driving through it in one of those monstrous truck things. He had taken a doe and covered it up in the back with a sheet of that black plastic material. Since Hearn was not with me at the time, I took it upon myself to avenge the doe, and I followed him in my chariot to the city.
She began to pour some of the smoothie into the glass, and it looked pretty good. I found myself hoping she was in a sharing mood, and then I remembered that Flittish has a chariot pulled by stags, and I thought that even the reserved British of today would behave badly when confronted with something like that on the highway. You were invisible to mortals during this chase, I presume?
Of course.
Her hands froze, and her green eyes flashed at me with a temper that matched the flame of her hair.
What kind of huntress do you take me for?
Whoops. I lowered my eyes and spoke down to her boots, the soft brown leather sort with tough yet pliant soles like moccasins. They rose to her knees, where she had some tan leggings tucked into them, also leather and well worn. But the leather didn't stop there. She'd never met a piece of it she didn't like, as long as it wasn't black.